Welcome to today's episode of the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. Today, we are going to talk about where the Air Force is going when it comes to its next fighter. We're going to hear from General Mark Kelly, the commander of Air Combat Command, one of the service's top leaders and a driving force in this realm. As we heard from our last episode when we spoke to F-35 pilots Major Hazard Lee and Captain Beowulf, the air superiority mission has changed thanks to fifth-generation technology. The combination of stealth, incredible situational awareness, sensors, computing power, and real-time sharing of information through data links, along with advanced performance characteristics, has fundamentally changed how pilots fly and fight. Now, it's time to move past the idea of two opponents seeing one another and engaging in a classic dogfight. Instead, thanks to the incredible sensors, the processing power, and the ability to real-time construct a massive picture, missiles will be launched at extreme ranges, and an adversary will likely never know it hit them. Because thanks to stealth, electronic warfare systems, and high situational awareness, we will be best set up for the first kill. The opponent will never even know that he was at risk. So that brings us to the point of today's show, the Air Force's future plan to secure air superiority. Joining me to discuss this is Mitchell Dean, Lieutenant General retired, David Deptula. Sir, great to have you here.
Well, thanks, Slick. I've got to tell you, everything you've been describing is 100% on target from my perspective. Yet words really fall short to describe the gravity of the situation that we face. Everything you describe is well known around the world. Our friends recognize it, and that's why they're lining up to buy fifth generation aircraft like the F-35, while also, in some cases, designing their own examples like the United Kingdom's Tempest effort. It's also why new collaborative concepts like the manned unmanned teaming Skyborg program are built around the attributes of stealth, information dominance, and data sharing. You either fly and fight like this or you're going to be dead. But that's not how our Air Force is built today. We've got too many jets that are too old and simply won't make it in a high-end conflict. We got complacent in the 2000s fighting low-tech adversaries in Iraq and Afghanistan. People failed to appreciate how fast our opponents were pressing forward, and we pulled back on the throttles at the very wrong moment. To be blunt, much of our problem goes directly back to the 2009 decision to terminate the F-22 with just 187 airframes produced, which, for our audience's edification, was less than half of the validated military requirement. Then Secretary of Defense Bob Gates was desperate for cash to fund counterinsurgency operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. He had a fixed budget in the Pentagon, so he began gutting future investment. The problem with this is that any defense dollar committed by Congress today won't start impacting things on the front lines for years. It takes a long time to get items on contract, produce them, and then integrate them into the military system. So any investment decision needs to look to the future, thinking about the world we'll live in then, the missions that will exist then, and the future threat. Now, the F-22's early termination did exactly the opposite. It locked us into living with older combat aircraft designs for decades longer. And while the F-22's fifth generation partner, the F-35, continued, challenges in development, inconsistent funding from Congress, and a slower than planned production ramp rate have seen way too few jets flow to operational units. This has created a heck of a problem with an Air Force badly out of balance from a technology perspective. So let me provide an example that our audience can relate to. Last time I checked, I didn't see too many First World War Sopwith Camels flying in World War II. But that's basically the kind of imbalance we have today with a fighter aircraft inventory averaging over 30 years in age. Now, I'm the only Air Force officer who was fully combat mission qualified in the F-15 in every rank from lieutenant to lieutenant general. So I know and love the F-15. But going to war in an F-15 today would be like going to war in Vietnam in a P-39. the frontline fighter going into World War II.
Well, sir, of course, I totally agree. And the answer to this involves multiple vectors. The first thing is we need to stick to the advanced technology we know works and is coming off the line today. And that means doubling down on our commitment to the fifth generation types like the F-35. But it also means exploring new concepts like manned, unmanned teaming, which we discussed a couple episodes back. But we also need to think about what's next for air superiority. It all comes back to the point that dollars committed today do not realize combat power for years.
That's exactly right, Slick. And the case is even more extreme when it comes to innovating new concepts. This is a process that can take a decade or more by the time requirements are drafted, industry comes up with offerings, competitions held, the design selected, a winning company then refines their design with the digital engineering and actual flight trials, and then operational production capacity is finally built. That's a very complex process. So if we want to think about fielding a new air superiority aircraft in the 2030s, or even the 2040s, the time to do that is now. Now, the good news is that the Air Force has been thinking about this for a long time. The public first heard about it in 2015, when then Chief of Staff General Mark Welch assembled a varsity group under the leadership of then Brigadier General Grinkiewicz to look at all the options, ranging from what the effects we would want to secure in this mission area to the threat and what technology would likely allow. These folks did a really fantastic job. And you can even find an unclassified summary of their thinking that Grinch wrote for the Mitchell Institute on our website. They kept an incredibly open mind and probed all the angles. Over the following years, the effort continued to evolve, most of it taking place in classified settings. And now the effort is known as Next Generation Air Dominance, or NGAD. And that brings us to today's guest, Air Combat Command Commander General Mark Kelly, who goes by the call sign Grace. As we've explained before, a major command commander's job is to organize, train, and equip the combat forces that the combatant commanders then use to engage around the world, whether it be a peacetime deployment in a given theater, are fighting an actual war. So when things heat up in the Pacific or Europe, those commanders call General Kelly for many of the forces they need. He and his team are also instrumental in helping manage and develop the Next Generation Air Dominance program. But with that, Grace, thanks again for being with us today. I'd like to kick things off with a big picture question. When you hear from commanders who want capabilities and capacity from Air Combat Command, what are the high demand forces?
Well, thanks. That's starting off with a pretty broad question. And in terms of capabilities, well, the combatant commander's answer to what they want is more, and I mean more of all of it. And that's not a criticism, that's just an acknowledgement of the high regard that the combatant commanders hold our airmen and their capabilities, and acknowledgement that the Air Force is too small for what the nation needs it to do. In terms of fighter capabilities, more so than platforms, again, the command commanders need a wide range of capability, from forward air control of close air support to high-end air superiority. And just like ISR, the command commander needs a fighter force that can persist in a permissive environment and penetrate in a non-permissive environment. There are some exceptions. Example, as you might expect, I haven't heard, nor do I expect to hear, of Joe Van Herk from NORTHCOM calling for CAS capabilities. But by and large, the geographic combatant commanders are keen to have capabilities from across the fighter portfolio to work their problem sets. Thanks.
Well, thanks for that. As a bit of a follow-up, and that was sort of a nice segue to what I wanted to get your perspective on next, and that's when considering the fighter force, how does your available force structure match up with the folks required at the various combatant commands around the globe? And I would take it that, you know, your previous answer that they always want more is probably applicable here too. Is that the case?
It is. You know, our fighter force is optimized for the low end permissive environments up to medium threat, Syria, Iran, North Korea environment of combat operations. for the combatant commanders in our pacing theaters, we greatly benefit and need capable allies with their own high-end platforms and weapons and air-based defense capabilities. You know, in terms of various COCOMs around the globe, the one that keeps me focused and maybe even keeps me up at night is NORTHCOM. Simply put, the last time we were in a Cold War, we had this thing called Aerospace Defense Command, and the sole purpose was to defend the sovereign airspace of North America. We all know that great power competition is back in vogue, and this time there's two peer adversaries, but there's no Air Defense Command. So 60 years ago, besides their squadrons of F-102, F-101, F-104s, Air Defense Command had 28 dedicated F-106 fighter interceptor squadrons on alert. Now, there'll be rational people who contend that the threat was different, and they'd be right. But I'd argue that while adversary cruise missile technology has not outpaced our technical ability to detect and defeat it, it has outpaced our efforts to resource and defend against it.
Excellent point. Slick?
Well, sir, this is Slick Baum. I just wanted to say thanks for being here. And with what you've said so far, what does this really tell you about the fighter force that you think we need as the United States Air Force to build for the future from a capacity and capability standpoint?
Yeah, the capacity and capability equation consumes a lot of our time here, especially with our 589 and with our partners at HAF, John Nahum and the AEA. But when it comes to capacity and capability of our weapon systems, we aren't as powerful as what we own as a service on a spreadsheet. We're only as powerful as what we can project and protect forward, sustain, and credibly operate. We have to have high-end utility capacity that's usable because it's sustainable and it's viable. Our combat Air Force fleet is twice as old as United States Navy's, and it's three times as old as the Royal Australian Air Force. That means we're literally hemorrhaging readiness to care, feed, and supply an older fleet. Viable means basically, quote unquote, a full up round. It has the relevant sensors, the weapons, the current modifications needed to compete. And I know there's been a lot of discussion, whether it be on our networks here and different venues, for example, like on the F-15EX. But it's a key part of our required capability capacity mix. You know, a pure fight requires range, payload, advanced sensors that can thrive in a difficult EMS environment. I'm happy to talk with anybody about what the F-15EX will or won't bring to the fight. And I'd recommend anyone out there talk to someone who's operationally flown both the F-15E with an APGD-2 and EPAWS and other advanced sensors, and also flown operationally the F-35 if they want to talk relevancy and contributions to a peer fight. In terms of changing the age of our fleet, that requires we improve our narrative to effectively convey the debilitating impacts of old and high maintenance weapon systems. Part of our required change, and also changing the collective understanding that our service and our nation, for that matter, has of our adversaries. You've seen Chinese and Russian advances with stealth, weapons, precision navigation, et cetera. Those are credible gains, but they don't keep me up at night. But if you've listened to General Brown's recent comments on the electromagnetic spectrum, that's what keeps me up at night. I'm talking from extremely low frequencies down to 3 hertz, all the way through the HF, VHF, UHF, all the way through our sensing and C2 bands into the IR spectrum and ultraviolet wavelengths. Our adversaries' EMS advances combined with 5G, quantum computing, and artificial intelligence are what they'll use to close their red kill chains and what they'll use to break blue kill chains. This is not a secret. They're messaging us on this topic. You know, one of the most quoted military figures in World War II was the British Army General Bernard Law Montgomery. And one of his most famous and I'd say accurate quotes was when he stated, quote, "If we lose the war in the air, we'll lose the war and we're going to lose it quickly." I'd contend that if we lose the war in the electromagnetic spectrum, we're going to lose the war and we're going to lose it quickly. So to that end, we have to have capability that's affordable and truly resilient across EMS. So we can penetrate an adversary's airspace, cyberspace, and decision space at a time, place of our choosing. And as I mentioned at the start, this is not just a fighter force challenge. We must acknowledge that unlike our allies who operate the E-7 Wedgetail, the U.S. does not possess a state-of-the-art airborne moving target indicator capability. AMTI is a key tenet of air superiority, and if we don't unambiguously articulate the asymmetric advantage we've enjoyed from air superiority over the last 70 years, when I say we as a joint force and we as a nation, if we don't clearly explain the strategic requirement to fully fund next generation air dominance, it'll be the most expensive money we ever save, because neither air superiority nor victory on airmen's or Americans' birthright, and both are at significant risk. I am personally confident that we'll generate better solutions once we acknowledge the real possibility of losing a peer fight. Or to quote President Biden 2 weeks ago, when referring to China, when he said, quote, if we don't get moving, they're going to eat our lunch, unquote.
That's a great set of perspectives, Grace, and really appreciate that in yielding some insights to our audience. Could you please tell us how this situation that you just described is shaping the Next Generation Air Dominance Program? We hear a fair amount about this effort, but could you help us better understand its macro level parameters?
Yeah, sure. Since I started off going back with Air Defense Command in history, I'll revisit history with NGAD. If we were sitting here in 1945, having come out of World War II with our P-51s, you know, that generation's air dominance, then the F-86 program development would be incredibly exciting, game-changing, and likely be referred to as NGAD of the early 1950s. 1960s NGAD would be the F-4 and the F-106. 1970s NGAD, as you well know, was the F-15. And the 1990s NGAD was the F-22. Each one of these capabilities and platforms was uniquely informed by the modern threat, the modern technology of the day, to keep a qualitative military advantage, as well as the knowledge that failure to stay ahead of your adversaries in this domain is the surest path to kinetic defeat. You know, you think of our Air Force, what it would look like without the previous generations of air dominance. Probably more appropriate, how our joint force would have fought, you know, Korea without the F-86. That was a tough fight all the way back to the Pusan perimeter, and it would have been a tougher fight with iron bombs raining down on U.S. servicemen. Think about how we'd have fought Desert Storm, obviously a fight you're well familiar with, without first sweeping the skies with F-15s. You know, our joint force is optimized, and it's been accustomed to controlling the air domain for the past 70 years. Air superiority has been the joint force's asymmetric advantage that's provided the freedom of movement, ensures the ground forces focus forward. They don't focus upward. To your question, I think you used the phrase macro parameters. I think you just need to look at what shaped the F-15, the F-22 development in terms of threat, available technology, and environment. You know, it was the Soviet Union, European basing, airspace, front quarter, mechanically scan, expand radars. Well, we need to move beyond just the Russian threat lay down, move beyond just European basing airspace engagement ranges, and move beyond 80s and 90s technology in defeating a single mech scan, single band sensor. Thanks.
Well, sir, of course, we're disappointed that you didn't tell us exactly what it was going to look like. But no, that leads me into my next question, because, of course, when we think about next generation air dominance, of course, people are thinking, you know, it's a new improved F-22 or something along those lines. And at the same time, we have tremendous emerging technology coming out that obviously can help us secure future air superiority. So obviously, we want to embrace those new concepts and not fall into the trap of what we think a fighter, quote unquote, should look like. So not putting you on the hook for what it does look like, but where do you see the biggest change in coming from in that regard?
Yeah, thanks. I'm going to, for security and ease, I'll stick with a little bit of the history lens that I got myself off on. But, you know, when Germany was losing the ground in World War II and faced greater allied capacity, they went through their own chapter of quote unquote accelerate, change or lose. In doing so, they knew to not go linear. They went exponential and did not try to develop the next best piston fighter, because anything less than a radical change in capability meant sure defeat. So they developed the ME-262, which wildly outclassed anything the Allies had. Problem was, it was truly game-changing in the face of overwhelming Allied capacity. By the summer of 1944, it was too little, it was too late. With respect to your question on, you know, biggest changes, I'd say mission systems and sensors. Again, F-22 is a world beater, but the Raptor was designed in the 80s with 80s technology, and we've worked really hard to keep it current. We need 2020 technology for air dominance. You know, for example, unlike traditional vehicles of the 80s and the 90s, you know, a Tesla, it uses multiple video cameras, ultrasonic, like sonar sensors and radar. The entire thing is a sensor package in communication with every other Tesla. It knows when it needs a software update. It knows when specific maintenance is required. It's by definition multispectral and 360 degrees. You know, like previous technology discussion on the ME-262 in the air domain, Tesla's technology is game-changing in the road domain. But the key is that it's game-changing at scale. And if you want to win, you need game-changing at scale.
Obviously, when we talk about what fifth generation brought to the fight and some of the construct was really having, you know, the all-in-one sensor fusion and communication coming together. When we think about things like the Air Force's JADC2 or DARPA's Mosaic Warfare, having a more disaggregated approach where, you know, system functions maybe hosted on different platforms, how do you see NGAD falling into this mix?
Yeah, thanks. If I'm picking up correctly on your question, which is never guaranteed, with respect to holistic solutions, I'm confident that our classic kill chain will migrate more to a kill web. You know, F-15s in Desert Storm normally on average had a 75 nautical mile commit range from our E-3 AWACS detection, and then they would close and complete their radar to radar missile linear kill chain. But the shooter, in this case an F-15, still need to organically generate a weapons quality track to employ its own ship weapon. You know, today an F-35 can be many miles away and receive MADL targeting tracks, air or ground, from other F-35s that are weapons quality. Being a below average F-35 pilot, I knew whether I had a weapons quality track to shoot at or not, but I didn't have the data cross-check, frankly, the skill, or for that matter, did I really care which blue player provided it? As far as NGAD contributing to a kill web, I think it'll contribute in two ways. As an advanced sensor, way forward in the enemy's backyard, and a shooter way forward in the enemy's backyard. In the blue kill web, it might be doing the sensing while another platform's doing the shooting, or vice versa. But putting a sensor, or for that matter, a shooter, in an enemy's backyard is important along numerous lines of effort, whether it be time, range, concealment, psychologically, et cetera. Thanks.
Thanks for that, Grace. How do you see the goal of defeating an enemy's find, fix, track target, and kill process evolving? I mean, you talked a bit about this in the past, and you mentioned that in the 90s we had stealth, and today it's really become, you know, stealth is sort of entry level, but I mean, it's a combination of stealth, electronic warfare, and high fidelity situational awareness, thanks to sensors and processing power. Where do you see this combination going in the future?
Yeah, if you're talking about a specific singular air platform, defeating an adversary's kill chain for survival, well, it's multispectral from low band all the way through an IR and ultraviolet wavelengths. But there's more to kill chains and kill webs, as you know, than own ship survival. We have to factor in the exponential growth in technology and the exponential proliferation of capability when we chat and discuss kill chains. And what I mean by this, and kind of please excuse the train of thought as I deviate away and then navigate back to NGAD. You know, back in, I think it was August of 2020, a U.S. commercial satellite, and it was from a small company called Planet Labs. They picked up a Chinese Shang-class nuclear fast attack sub entering the Yulon naval base in Hainan Island. Now, I don't know, honestly, if this satellite just happened to be looking down there on a clear day, or maybe cued by social media intel hits, other cueing, I frankly, I don't know. But the point is, that if a small U.S. company can find, fix, track, generate coordinates on a key peer adversary target, then a determined peer nation state with a multispectral constellation cued by AI algorithms and processed by 5G is very likely to be able to find, fix, track, and generate target coordinates on your terrestrial crown jewels, as well as your, well, for that matter, Aaron, surface assets. So that means you have to complicate the targeting phase. And just like the Chinese continued to drive their sub into that same underground facility to complicate precise targeting. And part of your defense is that you have to be able to interdict and break the kill phase. As I mentioned above, previous question, putting NGA in your enemy's backyard connected to a sensing grid that's, for example, staring at that, we'll just say, for example, that same underground sub base and 1,000 other areas of interest, and they're not waiting for the sub to poke its nose out, but cued by maybe an AI hit that, for example, knows that the tugboats needed to undock it have already started engines. And they know that it's going to pull out at, say, minute 35 to 37. So guess what? We're going to have somebody draw their bow back at about minute 34.
Sir, as you look at NGAD, how do we avoid frustrations of past programs that took forever to develop, saw significant cost increases, and ultimately got cut before required procurement buys were met? To be blunt, we can't risk another B-2 or F-22. How do you see NGAD addressing the situation?
Well, thanks. And since we're being blunt and we're being specific, I'd say not only can we not risk another B-2 or F-22, we can't risk another F-35 to where the incentive is long-term sustainment and long-term modernization efforts towards eventual relevancy. We have to get our arms around the capability, availability, and affordability lines of effort. And I'd offer that our choice is either a century of capability or a half century of ops sustainment, meaning we have to rapid spiral per the digital century series of capability and put the focus on leading edge relevancy through industry competition, or hunker down for more than a half century of operations and sustainment growth from vendor lock. Thanks.
Gray, sort of a related question. How do we ensure future combat aircraft can be updated in a rapid fashion, especially when it comes to software, so that we can out-innovate our adversaries at the speed of need, not necessarily bureaucracy?
Yeah, good question. You know, beyond the digital engineering and design, part of the digital trinity is the agile software development, the open systems architecture. You don't climb in your car, or drive to a store, and stand in line every time your smartphone needs a software update. It comes to you. And if you still don't have time to load it when they tell you to, it automatically loads itself. And you don't change out your hardware every time there's an update either. That would be too cumbersome, too slow, and too costly. I'm confident we'll adopt, you know, leading edge agile software development and open mission systems to keep our systems updated and current and relevant.
And sir, we know NGAD has struggled on the Hill. Frankly, Congress has taken money from the program. And what's your assessment on why this is occurring? And how do you think we change the approach?
I think we've been challenged in our narrative, you know, from multiple angles. One, it's hard to articulate a basic need for air superiority as a value proposition that's existential to our nation when people have never experienced life without it. And our joint force has never fought without it. Most of the people of Texas never wanted for heat and clean water until the recent cold snap and infrastructure failure. People in Western U.S. never wanted for water until there was a sustained drought. We don't sit here during this conversation consciously thinking about the oxygen we're breathing, but go about 30 seconds without it, and it'll be the only thing we think about until you get it back. When these basic tenets of our existence are taken from us, there's no question they're necessities and we need them back, like now. So see the air domain and then try to operate below it or above it, and the joint force will want its own oxygen back. If we don't have the tools and the capabilities in place left to bang, just like the example I gave earlier of trying to field the ME-262 at scale in 1944, it's too late. you've lost. The other reason it's tough to talk about NGAD is, well, it's demonstrating in this interview in my sometimes incomplete, always evasive answers, that the vast majority of the subject outstrips a classification of 99% of both the people in the venues that you find yourself in. And this topic needs to be discussed in small vaults with important decision makers. And a pandemic is not conducive to getting important people into small spaces. As far as changing that approach, although hope is not a strategy, I'm hopeful that now that we're post-election and we start to get towards post-pandemic, that opportunities to discuss with key leaders become easier. We have to tell our story. We have to give best military advice, provide reasoned dissent, and then execute decisions that are made. Thanks.
Grace, we've talked a lot about hardware past couple of minutes and really appreciate your insights. Let me switch gears just a bit and ask, how do you see the role of the fighter pilot changing, given everything we've spoken about regarding future aircraft? And a little bit of a follow-on up front, I know you're looking at the redesign of how fighter pilots are trained and brought to a level of experience, and it's called Reforge for short. How important is this program to ACC's ability to meet the challenges of the future threat?
Yeah, thanks. As you watch fourth-gen pilots that are experts at leading formations, controlling intercept geometry, highly technical radar operators, and disciplined tactical communicators, you watch them venture into the fifth-gen world with more automated sensors, automated communications. You see that the requirements to be successful in fifth-gen employment surround a lot of data management. Some signature management and lots of timeline management. All that managing doesn't make them less fighter pilots. It's just a different set of critical skills. Transitioning a fifth gen aviator to sixth gen, we'll see another leap in sensing, processing, automation, and data management. But in the end, whether it's a P-51 or sixth gen platform, the same warrior mentality is required to trust the best technology American science can produce, go forward to the sound of the guns, execute with discipline, and then leave your adversary's jet cartwheeling in a ball of flame and leave your adversary floating down in a parachute. As far as the seasoning of aviators, as you mentioned with the Reforge, if you just take a quick lens in at our formal training units, it doesn't matter if it's a F-16, F-15E, any fighter formal training unit, those units get pulled every day left and right. And what I mean by that is, the great T-38 that trained me and you and lieutenants today has served us very well, but it becomes one more day less relevant to a modern training regimen every day we wait on the T-7. So the FTUs get pulled left to make up a gap into fourth gen plus fifth gen leap of technology. Also, every single day, our adversaries increase their capability. So the FTUs are pulled to the right to help bridge that capability gap. So our operational units don't have to shoulder it all themselves. So seasoning our aviators and getting them just the reps and the sets of doing ordinary skills extraordinarily well so they can focus on the tactics is key. So we have to find a new way through either Reforge or other venue to try to get our young aviators that foundational skills they need. Like I said, just to do ordinary skills extraordinarily well. Thanks.
Well, sir, we live in an era of fifth-gen fighters carrying third-gen missiles. And how do we narrow this gap with the sixth-generation world coming on board? What do munitions look like from a capabilities and effects perspective?
It's a good question. And I'd take just a slight exception with fifth-gen aircraft carrying third-gen missiles to more accurately fifth-gen aircraft carrying fourth-gen missiles. But your point is fair. We have to advance our weapons along with our platforms. Regardless if we're talking about a specific platform, doesn't matter if it's bomber, ISR, fighter, manned, unmanned, a peer fight requires or retain the capability and range to penetrate and thrive in a multispectral, highly contested fight. Same with a air-to-air or a air-to-ground munition. It has to have the range and the multispectral capability to thrive in a very, very contested peer fight. as mentioned before, I'm not going to talk about specific waveforms or specific ranges or blast frag patterns. You know, munition capability and capacity is a key topic. But I can tell you that I think more about the kill chain, the kill web, than I do the final kinetic closure and kinetic solution. Thanks.
Well, Grace, I can't thank you enough for your time here today. What you and your team do at Air Combat Command is second to none.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you guys up in D.C. and around the MAGCOM Commander Conference or future venue. And I hope you guys are doing well through this season of winter.
Well, General Deptula, you know what struck me the most about that conversation is the open-minded approach General Kelly is taking with meeting the future requirements. I was in the Pentagon back when Grinch was leading that initial assessment effort, and I remember that they were working so hard to avoid falling into the trap of preconceived notions that folks wouldn't ever really refer to what they were doing as this thing being a fighter. And that's why they were focused on the effect they wanted, which was air dominance, not the means in the form of an aircraft. So I'm glad they're continuing this mission-oriented approach.
Well, Slick, I tend to totally agree. Just as we're seeing fifth-generation aircraft completely change how we fly and fight, I know this next step will be a significant evolution, and it should be. If we keep doing things in a linear way, each step slightly better than the next, but basically the same, we simply make it easier for the enemy to anticipate and counter. We could also find ourselves failing to take advantage of new pieces of technology because they didn't fit our paradigm of what a fighter should look like given current concepts. So that's why we always need to be focused on how to better achieve the end mission goal, not just the slightly better version of what already exists. And we see this all around us today. I mean, who would have ever thought a cell phone would become a smartphone? But they got there by being effects focused, not welded to the next best flip phone.
And sir, I want to bring up a point that General Corley made a few episodes back. Just because we're stepping out on NGAD doesn't mean we can stop building solutions that can be implemented today. He said, if it's always about program next, you'll never have a program at all. And I think that's so important for us to focus on. And it's really important because the closer an aircraft gets to production and fielding, the more issues that arise that have to be solved. And it's easy when it's a simple concept. We can wish things away and just say, oh yeah, we'll figure it out later. It's a lot harder when the solution has to happen now and it's tax dollars and of course, schedules slip. And that's when tempers flare, the skeptics pounce and the program faces political headwinds. But this isn't new, whether we're looking at what folks face when they feel the B-52 or the F-16 or C-17, every program goes through this. And the key is recognizing the challenges and working towards smart solutions so the investment can be realized in an operational quantity that speaks to the challenges of today and tomorrow.
Well, Slick, I'm really glad that you said that. Modernizing an Air Force involves a lot of moving parts. We have to maintain the jets currently on the line. We need to build what's in production, and we need to innovate what's next. And doing this concurrently, especially when money is tight and the threat environment is evolving as fast as it is really a tough charge. But I'll tell you, going off what General Kelly said today, I'm really encouraged where he, his team, and the Air Force as a whole are tracking when it comes to NGAD. This is going to be a crucial program, and I think these guys are on target.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for today's discussion. And to you, our listeners, thank you for tuning in to today's episode of The Aerospace Advantage. If you like what you've heard today, hammer down on that like, follow, and subscribe button wherever you download The Aerospace Advantage. As always, you can join in the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn, or by visiting us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, I'm John Baum. Fly safe and check six.